Welcome to the Silent London Podcast, Episode 8, presented in association with SOAS Radio. Ladies, please remove your hats. Hello, I'm Pamela Hutchinson, the editor of the Silent London website, and I'll be your host. With me in the studio today, you'll find producer Pete Barron. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Pamela.
We're back in the studio for a full-length episode of the Silent London Podcast, and it's a good thing too, as we have plenty to talk about. We'll be talking about the first silent films that we and you ever saw. We're looking forward to the British Silent Film Festival, and we're hearing from silent film director Alex Barrett about his favourite silent movie. Plus, we'll be rounding up some recent silent cinema news, which may involve getting into an argument, and we'll be reviewing a classic silent film starring Greta Garbo and John Gilbert. If you want to get in touch with us about anything you hear on the podcast, leave a comment at silentlondon.co.uk, tweet me at Silent London, or leave a message on the Facebook page, facebook.com/silentlondon. We've been to a couple of silent movie festivals together this year, the Hippodrome Festival of Silent Cinema in Bowness back in March and the Kennington Bioscope here in London. Not to show off, but I've been to Bologna as well. So what makes a good silent film festival, do you think?
Oh, well, you'd be the person to know. You've been to way more than me. But I think a good festival has to have a reason to exist. I think, and those reasons can be all sorts of things. It can be the films themselves, so it could be, you know, something like the Slapstick Festival. They've got a theme, they've got an idea, that's what they program around. Or it could be a regional thing, so you talk about the British Silent Film Festival, which is broad but does make an effort to try and find British films and sort of put the spotlight on British stuff. But sometimes it's the location. So Bowness is very much about the town as well as the silent films.
And the cinema itself.
Oh, a beautiful cinema. I mean, wonderful place. And I think and to get the right kind of atmosphere, you need that. And if your atmosphere is going to be built around a town or around a space, then that's the thing you've really got to be pushing. I mean, I don't know about the international festivals that you've been to. I mean, can you tell me a bit about how they work?
Oh, well, you have to get on a plane and go very, very far away. I have to say, I mean, Bologna, which I went to this summer, it's not really about the location in as much as the cinemas. They're sort of quite functional spaces. Mm-hmm. But the main highlight is always the screenings in the Piazza Maggiore, which I've probably pronounced completely wrong, which is the main square in Bologna. It's a really beautiful place, and it's also sort of the hub of the city, so you have people who are sort of on their way home and they stop to watch the Buster Keaton show. And I went to see, the first year I went to Bologna a couple of years back, I went to see Rome Open City in the Grand Square, and to be watching that film newly restored with a massive crowd of Italian film fans was really something special. You get a similar kind of buzz off the atmosphere in the Bowness cinema, the Hippodrome cinema in Bowness, as you're talking about. So what did you enjoy most at the Hippodrome Festival? I know it's a long time ago now.
It was so long ago now. I mean, I think the gala performance, I mean, in the end, it was just being in the town, really, a lot of it. I mean, I went to one site-specific thing, which was the item at the station, which is great. And I think that kind of thing can be really nice. And I think with something like that, I think what you were talking about Bologna there, about the interaction between film buffs and the city, and the city sort of saying that we are these people as well. And certainly in Bowness, half the crowd were locals, and who, if there wasn't a silent film festival in their own town, would probably never go and see a silent film. So they're willing to experiment, and there is that nice sense when people are when people are discovering things for the first time. And you know, silent film fans, all fans of anything, can get quite jaded and go, oh, okay, there was Piccadilly again or whatever. You know, I love Piccadilly, but
Piccadilly at the Hippodrome was quite amazing.
Yes,
yeah.
Which I didn't actually see Piccadilly at the Hippodrome. I gave that one a miss, or I didn't get a ticket, to be more precise. I
mean, that was, snooze you lose.
I mean, that was what was amazing about Bowness, was that, you know, it is such a small place and it is such a small town, but it did sell out pretty much two or three weeks before, because I didn't get tickets to anything. I had to sort of scrimp, save and beg. You very kindly passed a ticket or two over to me, and I did get some off the locals. But it was tough, and that's great, because when it started, of course, it was just it's such a strange idea. It feels like a strange idea.
Yeah, so, you know, hats off to Ali Strauss. I think, I mean, obviously, you know, there were some great films shown at Bowness, but one of my highlights was the Saturday night when they showed another film I'm going to mispronounce, Salt vs. Venetia.
Yes, which I also didn't see.
Yeah, it's quite a tough watch. It's not Saturday Night Entertainment. It had a great live score by a band called Moshe's Bagel. I think they're taking that on tour. But it was full of local people. And, you know, if anyone was going to be offended by something a little bit edgy, a little bit too vivid, then that's the film to put the frighteners on you. But, you know, people enjoyed it because they were open-minded enough to think, you know, want to see a silent film, show us what you've got.
Well, I think there, again, it's the choice of music. And one of the great things about Silent Film Festival, of course, is that a good silent film festival, that you can get local bands or people who haven't been involved in silent film to actually create those scores, brings new people in, fans of bands and whatever, but also is a different way of looking at it. And again, we're so lucky in London to have so many silent films, but you do have the same people playing them. Well, that's not a bad thing. They are all fantastic. But
Peter would like to apologise. So
any silent film musician listening, no. But in the end, of course, there's only so much you can do, and the money can only stretch so far. Whereas within a festival, you can get some funding for some really good and interesting music. I mean, it's the noble failures are often as good as the amazing scores. And it's been a long time since I've seen a really bad silent film score in those situations, but you know, it's just really great to just see someone trying something new and not being stuck by what other people do in that situation. So
I mean, I think one of the best things at Bowness, which I missed, was the screening of Annie Laurie on the Sunday night with a new score by Shona Mooney, and I heard that it was absolutely rapturous in there. And of course I went to go and see it in London, and it was beautiful. I saw it at the Barbican. It's fantastic, beautiful music. I know that she worked really hard on it, and it you know, a real triumph. But I did sort of miss watching it in Scotland.
Seeing Annie Laurie in Scotland would have been better, even if it was for just the locals walking out afterwards going, Scottish, my ass.
Is that your Scottish accent?
It was my Scottish accent.
And it's very, very good.
Yes, yes. Well, yes. This is a silent film podcast, so you can always shut me up whenever you want to. I wanted to ask about Pordenone, because this is the one, of course, that I've always wanted to go to, and is always
and
a really
soon.
Bad. Well, it's a really bad time of year for me, but I should be able to sometime in the next couple of years. I mean, what's that? I mean, that seems to be super rarefied as well, and you know, really, really hardcore when it comes to silent film.
I think sometimes if you look at the lineup for Pordenone, you see films start at, you know, very early in the morning and they go until quite late. A lot of them are quite obscure. You have all these compilation programs. But actually, when you look at the lineup, you sort of miss the fact that most of these films are entertainment and you know, they're fun. So you might think, oh, what an arduous morning. I've got two Westerns and a romance. And again, the music's fantastic. And there's a real sense of community, because really, if you want to go to Pordenone, then you've got to love the films. And so you're just in a sort of massive theatre with a large group of people who all love this art form as much as you do. And, you know, there's a lot of sense of camaraderie and fun, you know, in the cafe and so forth afterwards. But it's in the cinema, you know, when they show something amazing, you can't beat the feeling. You really can't.
No,
you know,
I
and
imagine.
The excitement at gala nights all gets a little bit fancy. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to Pordenone this year.
No, it sounds good. I mean, I think that's the other thing as well, is that, you know, if it is a silent film festival, something builds itself as a silent film festival, then you are expecting predominantly silent film buffs at it.
Yeah.
Buff, this is the only time we ever use the word buff, I understand.
Well, I think we're both really buff.
In that other sense, I guess. So something like the British Silent Film Festival, which is coming up, which has been a bit itinerant, you know,
yeah,
over the last few years. But that's not necessarily a bad thing, I think, because it can pick people up who are interested, but at the same time we'll have a core central group of people who will be there. But I think there it is. It is very much about the film and isn't about the town. It isn't about not so much the community. You can do some great stuff around that, but the community you're expecting is the community of silent film fans, and they're the people who you're catering for most, I would say.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, time will tell. Obviously, the British Silent Film Festival this year, it's sort of going back to its roots in that it started in 1998 in Leicester, and now it is back in Leicester, a city I don't think I've ever visited. So
maybe not. It's lovely.
I'm very excited. There's the screening in the cathedral,
yes.
Jane Shaw with the beautiful musical accompaniment from Laura Rossi. And so there should be a little bit of that. I think time will tell. I think it's always a pity if these things feel closed off. And I'd like to think that people are coming down to the cinema in Leicester and buying the odd ticket for something.
Well, I hope so. And they have done, I mean, some of the programme which we'll get onto, I think there are some really interesting things. And again, you know, you're never going to go wrong with a Keaton double bill in the afternoon on Saturday. And, you know that in the end on Thursday afternoon and on Friday afternoon, that is probably pretty much going to be your hardcore silent film fans.
Yay.
But once you get into the evenings, then you can do, as you say, the interesting galas, some interesting music as well as and films that would attract someone just because they sound a little unusual as well. We've got a few of those to talk about a bit later. And another thing I was going to ask about, little things like the Kennington Bioscope weekend.
A little thing we love though, isn't it?
It was fantastic.
Yeah.
But I think that was again a nice little, here's a full-on immersion of that sense. I think we've mentioned after going to Bonus that one thing about Bonus is it's quite stretched out. You know, there's only three or four films a day. I mean, to most people sounds like a lot, but to those of us who are used to getting up at 9 and doing 9, 11, 1, 3, 5, 7, 9.
That's fun.
And, you know, certainly the Bioscope Weekender did that. And it was, you know, you'd get almost a little hallucinating by the end of the evening, but in a good way. Again, you get that immersion, which is a lovely feeling as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that's something that I always enjoy. And we should just say here that it's only just been announced, but the Kennington Bioscope team are putting on another festival. It's just a one-day festival. It's a Day of Silent Laughter in October. And I think their headline film there is going to be Girl Shy, but the program is still being nailed down. But that I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, that sounds great. And of course, one more to mention is the Manila Silent Film Festival, which is now in its sixth year. Which is the only silent film festival in Southeast Asia.
There you go.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
You've done your research.
I did.
Are you going to be heading there and reporting back?
I'll go there. Well, I think what's interesting, that's an interesting one because it's one of those ones where you look at the programme and you go, okay, well, those are the films that I would expect in a silent film festival, or, you know, beginning a silent film festival. But that's all about getting people interested and involved and trying to be as international as possible. Mm-hmm. And it's nice that even a place like that, which hasn't got much of a history of silent film, is still really into it. And again, some great local musicians and so on. So they're all over the place. And, you know, we haven't gone to San Francisco or some of the...
San Francisco is definitely on my bucket list. And the Loud Silence Festival in Finland. Yeah. And there's the Stummfilmtage in Bonn. So many. The San Francisco, please, if anybody wants to fly me there.
I'm more than happy to come out with you for that one as well.
Okay.
Obviously, I have been to San Francisco this year, but missed the festival, so...
Darn it.
Just missed it. And, of course, yeah, and if we can get our tickets to the Kodak restoring... film thing, whatever that's called.
Do you mean the Nitrate Picture Show?
That's
George
the one,
Eastman
yeah.
House.
Yeah, George Eastman House, the Kodak Restoring Film thing, as I think it's officially called.
Very similar. I mean, there's so many. I mean, you know, I'd love to go to Cinecon and all these things, and Telluride. And I just mention here, before we talk about British Silent Film Festival particularly, that the Cambridge Film Festival is coming up very soon in September, and they've got a little bit of silent action that we should talk about. First off, they've got some films about silent film. They've got the Edward Muybridge biopic Edward, and they've got the controversial Eisenstein movie directed by Peter Greenaway, and they've got the documentary From Caligari to Hitler. But more excitingly, there's a little Victor Sjöström. Victor Sjöström retrospective, which does have a couple of sound films, but it has four silents in its repertoire. It's got The Phantom Carriage, He Who Gets Slapped, and The Wind, three really famous Sjöström films there, and also an earlier one, The Outlaw and His Wife, which is one of his Swedish films, and they're all playing in September, I think. So if you go to the Cambridge Film Festival website, you can find out more about that.
That's wonderful.
So let's get down to it. We have both been poring over the schedule for the British Silent Film Festival because we're both going, and we've picked out three films that we want to talk about each. So Pete, would you like to go first?
Okay, the first one. So it's running from the 10th of September until the 13th. Is that right?
That's some important facts I should have mentioned.
Thursday starts with some talkies, which... okay, they've got a reason for it.
There is a reason. I think there is a bit of a theme at the British Silent Film Festival this year about how British cinema transitioned to sound, and I'm going to not use the word transitioned ever again.
But actually, I haven't been to sound films, obviously.
Obviously not.
Friday morning, I'm starting with The Rocks of Valpré, which is a Morris Elvey film from 1919, which is one of nine Elvey films from 1919. They churned them out.
He was a hard working man.
He was a hard worker. Now, I'm a big fan of Elvey. Who wouldn't be if you're into British silent film? But having seen the life story of David Lloyd George a few years ago, I do try and pick up whatever I can of Elvey's, and this is the year afterwards. Mm-hmm. Has a very, very overwhelming melodramatic plot, which we may remind me a little bit of Flesh and the Devil, actually, which we'll come to a bit later. Has a bit of a sense of that, i.e., someone's married to someone who's not sure whether she loves him.
This is Ethel M. Dell, isn't it?
Yes,
yeah.
That's right. It just looks like a good sort of, it will be well made. It'll look lovely and it'll be quite sweeping, I think. And that, I think, will start me off really well on that Friday morning.
Yeah, I like when I look at the description, you know, this dilemma that happens to so many of us when we've got a dashing young lover and instead we marry the sensible, rich and older man.
It is that dilemma that so many of us face, the youth and the wonders of that, and go, he's not going to be able to pay for me though, is he? And so in many ways, I think from a modern perspective, she's already made the bad decision.
Yes.
Or the right decision, who knows? You can learn to love money, I find.
Learn to love being rich, maybe, yeah.
So what's your first pick?
Okay, well, I have totally got mine out of order. I can't remember exactly when everything's on. The first one I'm going to talk about is Three Live Ghosts, because amusing title, and there's an incredibly amusing still on the British Silent Film Festival website, britishsilentfilmfestival.com, of a gentleman walking through a city with a baby carriage and a little sheep. So it's a famous story, apparently. This is a film that was recently re-found. It was thought to be lost for a long time. And it's about three chaps who come back from the army. I think they've been presumed dead and hence live ghosts, and find that things are not as they expected back on the home front. One of the reasons that it is showing here, and it's got an introduction by Charles Barr, which will give you a hint, is that it's a film that Alfred Hitchcock worked on. So that's quite exciting. It's actually thought that Alfred Hitchcock designed the intertitles for this film, which are now...
aren't actually in this version of the film.
They're gone. But as the programme politely points out, you can see the kind of film he was working on at that stage in his career. I think anyone who's interested in representations of, you know, how the war sort of affected, you know, real people back in Britain, this will be fun. And I think it's tickled my fancy.
No, it does look interesting. I think it's on Friday night, six-ish, I think.
But, and Norman Kerry, too.
Norman Kerry.
Yeah, go up. Your next one.
My next one is directly after my previous one on Friday morning. So Friday at 11:30, so I'm getting up early on Friday. It's Not For Sale, which is the...
But can you rent it? Well, is it on iTunes?
It's not for sale, but yes, you can go and see it one-off. Okay. And it probably isn't on iTunes, sadly. But this is, I mean, they know how to sell it to me on the British Silent Film Festival website. It's a Lydia Hayward scripted piece.
Of Manning Hayes fame.
And I've got to say, all the Manning Hayes, Lydia Hayward pieces, which are mainly W.W. Jacobs.
That's the ones we've seen, yeah.
Have all been great. Yeah. They've all been really good. I mean, they've all been... understated and smallish British films, but brilliant.
Just brilliantly judged, sort of just a perfectly delicate sense of humour that, watch them again and again.
Yeah, so there's that. And this one, it's directed by Will Colino, mm-hmm. Who did a lot of comedies in the UK, but is set in a Bloomsbury boarding house. And where we are right now...
Not too far.
We're slap bang in Russell Square, which is slap bang in the heart of Bloomsbury. So I've worked here for... 20 years, so seeing representations of Bloomsbury from 100 years ago will always tickle my fancy, and this just looks really interesting to me. So, and I think it's clearly not one of the headliners of the festival, but I think it's a really interesting film.
Well, I think that's a really interesting pick. I've found something to tickle my fancy, which is probably one of the most famous films in the lineup. Ivan Mustyukin. I can't pronounce his name, but he is a beautiful actor in both ways. And he stars in Mikhail Strogoff.
Not Mikhail Stroganoff, as I keep saying in my own head.
No. It's not so spicy, but it is rather special. Know. So we've got, this is a Pathé colour film. So we've got stencil print colour on this. We've got one of, you know, the silent era's greatest and most moving actors. And it's a bit of a spectacular. So it's an epic scale Serbian adventure adapted from a Jules Verne novel. So I think it's not going to disappoint on the eye candy front. And I've heard that it's quite an unforgettable watch.
I'm looking forward to it immensely.
Yeah. That's going to be my treat.
Does look good. My final of the three films is The Cosmic Voyage. And because I'm, you know, obviously a silent fiction fan,
quietly reading.
Supposedly, yes. Well, best way of doing it, a science fiction fan as well, obviously. And so I do love early stabs at science fiction and so on. And this is actually 1936, a Soviet film, Vasily Zhirevlov directed. I know very little about Vasily Zhirevlov. I understand this played to relatively rapturous applause at Pordenone.
Almost everyone I spoke to told me it was their favourite thing of the entire festival. It's one of the very few films I missed that year because I was too busy reviewing Too Much Johnson in my quiet hotel room like a loser. Everyone else went to watch The Cosmic Voyage and had a ball instead. But, you know, what I do for Silent London, guys.
There's a nice little trailer for it on the web, which just makes my heart sore seeing sort of the rocket ships and the sort of stabs at what it will be. I always loved these early representations of space travel where the crew are much more diverse than the crews ever were. So there's always a woman on the team, normally a kid, normally an old professor as well.
No dogs?
Doesn't appear to be a dog. I could be wrong.
That's disappointing.
It probably owes a little bit to Frauenmond.
Ooh, a film which you do not like.
But it is a good half the length of Frauenmond. So it will be. Yes, I'm looking forward to supplanting that as my go-to silent rocket ship movie.
So. We all need a good rocket ship movie. And also, that one's got a new score, hasn't it?
Yes,
of the show.
Yes, Neil Brand has got an electronic score, which, as it says in the notes, leans on, what are we looking at here?
Hans Zimmer and, is it Ron Goodwin?
Yeah, I think so. But I'm sure it'll be all Neil. But I'm looking forward to him. I'm assuming if it's an electronic score, then it's a stylophone.
Maybe. Who knows?
One little stylophone and maybe a kazoo. We'll see. It's very adaptable.
We could see the return of the British Silent Film Festival theremin.
Oh.
That's too much to hope for. So I've also chosen a film that's going to be premiering a new score at the festival, which is another... Why do I always pick words that I can't really say out loud? I think it's called The Guns of Loos.
I know, but it's spelled The Guns of Loos.
Yeah, which doesn't sound so good. So it's a 1928 film, so it's quite a late silent, directed by Sinclair Hill, and it's got Madeleine Carroll's first film role.
Swoon.
So that's something to recommend it. This is a film that I've actually seen a very short snippet of at the British Silent Film Festival a few years back. That was of a very sort of dramatic war battle sequence. And, you know, it's been on my radar since then. But to hear that we've got the full film with a brand new score and to see that this is a film that sort of deals with the home front as well as the front line, I'm quite excited about that. And I suppose I'm thinking of that again as another sort of big fun treat. That's Thursday night, so that's the first night we're there. So if I'm stay awake, because I've got that early train from London, I'm going to enjoy that hugely.
No, I think it will be I think it will be a hard film because it's, you know, it's a war film. But I think it will be an inspiring start to the film festival.
Well, there are a few more things to sort of mention about the British Silent Film Festival. There's a few films that I can say we've seen or, you know, we know quite well. We've got High Treason, we've got the sound version of that because they are talking a lot about the transition to sound. Lots of treats on that. We've got a film that stars or features a performance by the choreographer George Balanchine. And also there's a couple of Swedish films, which I saw at Pordenone a few years ago. The one's called The Strongest, which is kind of a love triangle thing, and one's called Kingdom of Rye, also... similarly, some sort of love triangle. I find that these Swedish films, and they sort of talk about the 20s as the golden age of Swedish cinema, they have their moments, have the longueurs, they can be quite slow, but it's always really quite stately. And if it's slow at any point, you can sort of ride it out because you know that the drama's coming. And they're really very rewarding to watch. And they've chosen two of the most staggeringly beautiful ones. So I'm really looking forward to that. And look... we're going to enjoy it all, aren't we?
We are. It's going to be a terrific weekend.
Fantastic. So that's the 10th to the 13th September.
Yep. In Leicester.
Not all British silent films are old ones. Filmmaker Alex Barrett is currently producing a new British silent film, a city symphony, in fact. London Symphony is a silent portrait of the capital city, and it's a project very close to Alex's heart, I know, as he is passionate about silent film. We asked him to tell us about his very favourite silent film, which is a real classic. It's The Passion of Joan of Arc. And just for your information, Alex recorded this for us back in March 2013, so my apologies for the delay, and enjoy.
Barrett, I'm a filmmaker. I wrote and directed a feature film called Life Just Is, and I also write a blog called Night on Planet Earth. And I think over the last few years I've really made no secret to the fact that my favourite film of all time is Carl Theodore Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc. When I reviewed the new Masters of Cinema Blu-ray for Silent London at the end of last year, I spoke about Dreyer's use of film grammar and how he fractures it in order to elevate the action beyond the physical world and sort of take it into a metaphysical realm. And I also spoke about how the film should be considered first and foremost as a human film rather than a religious film. That review's still up on the Silent London website, so rather than sort of repeat what I've already said, I wanted to talk on a more personal level about what Joan of Arc means to me. I first saw the film as part of a Goddard retrospective at the BFI. It was showing in a side strand of the season called Goddard in Context, and this was back in 2001 when I was 17 and working on my A-levels. I didn't really know anything about Dreyer at the time. To be honest, I'd never heard of him or of the film. But I was already a semi-regular at the BFI, or at the NFT as it was known in those days, and a friend of mine asked me if I wanted to go and see the film, so I basically just took a chance and went along. And my friend has a fairly rash aversion to anything even remotely religious, and sat there very uncomfortable throughout the whole film, sort of playing with his programme notes all the way through. Something was stirring within me. I couldn't really quite figure out what it was at that time, but the film had definitely made an impact. Around sort of 2002, about a year later, I realised that I was still thinking a lot about the film, and I really just couldn't get it out of my head. And at that time it was only available through the Criterion Collection, but luckily I could play American DVDs, so I ordered it. And it was then sort of watching it again that I really fell in love with the film. And since then it's been my favourite film. And I like to revisit it once or twice a year. And where possible, I try to never miss it when it shows on the big screen in London. I suppose at this point I could talk a little more about the technical aspects of Dreyer's filmmaking. But I'm not sure that would really help me to describe the effect that the film has on me. Although maybe it would help explain why the film has that effect. But despite his sort of mastery of the medium, the technical aspects weren't even really what interested Dreyer the most, as I think this quote from him shows, and this is related in The Cinema of Carl Dreyer by Tom Milne. What interests me, and this comes before technique, is to reproduce the feelings of the characters in my films, to reproduce as sincerely as possible feelings which are as sincere as possible. For me, the important thing is not only to seize the words they say, but also the thoughts behind those words. What I look for in my films, what I want to do, is to penetrate, by way of their most subtle expressions, to the deepest thoughts of my actors. For it is these expressions which reveal the personality of a character, his unconscious feelings, the secrets hidden deep within his soul. And I think this quote leads me on to another quote from Dreyer, which is, "The artist must describe inner, not outer, life." And this second quote would become very key to my conception of my debut feature, Life Just Is. And throughout the whole of the production and post-production, my team and I asked ourselves one question over and over again, which was, how can we best render the inner lives of our characters on screen? Like Dreyer, I wasn't really interested in naturalism per se, but in creating a sort of purified style through which I sort of hoped to explore the inner lives of my characters. I studied Dreyer's films in detail before making the film, and I have to say that I feel like I learned more about filmmaking from reading about his films and from watching them than I did from my 3 years at university studying film. And for me, Dreyer remains the most supreme artist that the cinema has ever produced. at his best, he is, I think, simply on a different level from all other filmmakers. And I do believe that Joan remains his greatest achievement. I think there remains a sort of general misconception of Dreyer that he's a sort of religious filmmaker. But I think a closer look at his films actually shows a greater preoccupation with the human than with the divine. And where the line gets blurred is that Dreyer shows us that the great sort of ineffable essence of what it means to be human. And he takes us closer to experiencing the inner life of another person than any other artist. He once described The Passion of Joan of Arc as a hymn to the triumph of the soul over life. And the word soul might sort of have religious connotations. But, you know, if you glance at a dictionary, it actually also says that a soul is the essential part or fundamental nature of anything. And I think that this is what Dreyer shows us in Joan, the sort of fundamental nature of humanity and of being. He has rendered, you know, Joan's soul on screen. And watching the film is the very sort of definition for me of a transcendental experience. It's sort of impossible not to be gripped, to be moved or be transported out of yourself. And that's why I believe it to be the greatest film of all time. Dreyer once said that the human face was a landscape that one never gets tired of exploring. But for me, it's not only Falconetta's face, but the Passion of Joan of Arc itself that I will never get tired of exploring.
You're a big fan of Passion of Joan of Arc, also.
I love it. Yes, it is one of the first silent films I saw. But I only saw it projected earlier this year at the Union Chapel.
With
the organ being played, and yes, it was after we had a little bit of a fight with some people who had sat in our seats. We then, you know, that's what happens when you see films in churches. People, you know, people pull up your pew. But it was really quite moving in the space. It's weird actually seeing it in a church because it's not the most pro-church film you can think of.
Not at all. I mean, it's very anti-clerical, but there's something about watching the film that film, which always comes across as a kind of mystical experience.
Oh, absolutely,
yeah. Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. Now, we're going to play a little bit of music now, and this is from another great silent film, and it's something quite dear to your heart. So let's kick it off. So, what were we listening to there, Pete?
So this is the final part of the Pet Shop Boys score to Battleship Potemkin, which they premiered in September 2005 in Trafalgar Square, and was what I would consider to be my first silent film experience.
Okay.
I had seen, obviously, a few silent comedies as a kid, and the now infamous, what everyone always says about Harold Lloyd, Chop Shops, but this is the first time I probably went out to actually physically see a silent film, and I possibly did it because it was the Pet Shop Boys doing it.
It's a good reason.
It was a good reason, but in the process, of course, fell in love with the film. And it was a wet night.
I've heard a lot about this screening.
Yeah, it was raining quite a bit, and yes, it was
England.
What are you going to do at the end of September? I'm looking at the moment at the open air screenings, which seem to be drifting on into October this year. And you're sitting there going, well, yes, it gets darker earlier, but it really is going to start raining and be cold.
Bring a blanket.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yes, but it was terrific. But it was, I mean, looking back at it now, and it's not something you can get along with the score. It doesn't quite, and the score doesn't quite fit the film or the versions of the film you can get, because they worked off whatever film they had. You know, we find an extra 30 seconds of every film every year. and it's probably not the greatest score. It's repetitive in places.
That's not so bad.
And some of the singing bits, which there aren't many singing bits in it, but some of them are incongruous, let's say.
They do love singing. I mean, I went to see the Pet Shop Boys ballet and there was singing and that, which seems, yeah, I mean, quite a devotion to singing.
in a ballet, I think there is an aspect of it is the Pet Shop Boys, and what is the Pet Shop Boys if there isn't singing, apart from obviously the wonderful sweeping keyboards. But yes, I mean, I still think that it was strong enough for the event, and it was, you know, I think also the choice of Battleship Potemkin for them was
perfect.
And so and of course it was a mayor weekend when Ken was still mayor, and Ken Livingstone introduced it as well.
Fantastic. So a red film,
very red film. what was your first silent film, Ben?
My first silent film experience was nothing like as spectacular as that. Again, I think I probably saw some snippets of Laurel and Hardy on the telly, but I look back, I remember the cartoons and the catchphrases, so possibly not. The first silent film I definitely watched was Un Chien Andalou. I watched it on VHS in a classroom in a sixth form college in West London, and I obviously liked it a lot because it did spark my interest in silent film, but I'm possibly the world's most squeamish person, so I actually found the process of watching this film nauseous, repellent, and really incredibly unpleasant. I didn't really want to ever see it again, even though I was intrigued by the imagery. We were studying David Lynch, and so this was a way to get us to think about surrealism.
Of course.
And it was such a great idea to show us that. They didn't know that they were going to make One Girl in the Back feel both queasy and kickstart a lifelong love affair with silent movies. We then saw a bit of Nosferatu, and I saw like Metropolis at college, and I just dug out Potemkin and things like that. But Un Chien Andalou was the one for me. I'm intrigued by this question because I do think, you know, do you wonder how many people go to see Saltfuss Venetia in Bowness and then embark upon a, you know, a career of silent film watching? So I asked the wonderful people who read and follow Silent London what their first silent films were, and we've got some of the responses here, haven't we?
Yes, we do, yes. I've got Alex Rayner, which starts with what I think might be quite relatively common, Laurel and Hardy, but he can boil it down to the actual film, was Big Business.
Big Business.
Big Business with James Finlayson, with his granddad sat him down to any Laurel and Hardy he could see. He had a picture on his bedroom wall till the day he died.
I'm not the only one who was traumatised by their first silent film. So I've got someone here who tweets as the name Cinema Nation. Mm-hmm. He said that they saw Battleship Potemkin again at the Museum of the Moving Image on the South Bank. That's a while ago.
Oh, yeah.
They were 8 years old and they were traumatised because the woman who was shot in the eye looked like her teacher. His teacher, I think. But, yeah.
I mean, the maggots are bad enough.
The maggots
will give you nightmares. I've got Ray Snook, who can't completely remember, but thinks that the first film to really make an impact on him was Docks of New York by Joseph von Sternberg, which opened his eyes to what silent cinema could really achieve.
That is a beautiful statement. And actually, Martin Contario, who is a lovely chap, who writes a lot about film, particularly about horror film quite a lot, as far as I'm aware, he says to me that he thinks his first film was also Un Chien Andalou, one of the very few films he would say changed his life because it opened his eyes, to a whole new art movement, one he felt he could call home. So that's beautiful, isn't it?
Nice. I've got two here. So one is Annette Barrett's first film was Greed.
Ooh.
And David Gill said to her, it was an initiation of fire.
She's not wrong.
She thinks that was an initiation of fire. Jesse Stevenson saw Napoleon when I was five at the Empire Leicester Square.
That's fantastic. I did notice when
I'm not quite sure how long the version she would have seen would have been, but it still probably would have rolled over 2 hours even then.
So I think it would have been quite long. Who knows? I mean, I'm sure she's only a wee thing. But I did hear towards the end of Napoleon when it was screened last in London, babies cry.
Mm.
I said there was a baby in the audience at some point.
I think there must be a baby conceived at the beginning of the film and then born near the end of the film.
I thought you were going to say graduated with a film studies degree by the end of it.
Quite possible.
We've got Tim Popple. Says here that his first silent film was Nosferatu. Loved it, and it converted me to vampirism.
I assume
so, yeah. And I must mention someone, because I've never come across this hashtag before. Townie Cook says that his first silent film was Laurel and Hardy. He's not sure which film it was, but it was screened on the back of a van parked opposite hashtag Blackheath Tea Hut. Crusty cheese roll 1960s, so funny. It's his rather enigmatic comment. Was a cheese roll funny? Was 1960 funny?
All of those things.
I suspect it was Lauren Hardy, but I've got to go to Blackheath.
You have to, and see if the van will turn up and say, come and see my Lauren Hardy film on back of my van. Do all my accents.
Enough of this looking backwards into our dim and murky past. We wanted to make sure you're up to date on all the silent film news that's been happening around here. So we're just going to talk about a few stories that we thought were of note. First up, something that just appeared on the blog this week. The announcement for this year's London Film Festival Archive Gala has been made. And it may surprise some people, but not many of you, to know that it's Anthony Asquith's Shooting Stars. So Anthony Asquith made three silent films. Underground and A Cottage on Dartmoor have already been restored and rescored and given the full BFI love. So Shooting Stars is his first silent film, co-directed with A.V. Bramble, but generally considered to be an Asquith film. And that is going to show at the London Film Festival, Odeon Leicester Square, October, and with a new score by John Altman. So are you looking forward to this one, Peter?
It sounds very exciting. I've not seen Shooting Stars, but obviously I've seen the other two. So to complete the hat trick will be amazing. I've heard good things. I understand it was Lawrence Knapper's first silent film.
Yes, he did say in his thing. We should have actually segued into that. He said his first silent film with live accompaniment was Shooting Stars. Neil Brand at the piano. And now he's a gosh darn silent film nerd.
Exactly. Go imagine, yeah.
Sorry, he's a film studies lecturer at King's College London.
Same thing.
And a friend of Silent London.
Friend of the show, they say. No, I am looking forward to that. And I mean, the galas are always great at the London Film Festival. And I think it's, again, going back to what we were talking about festivals beforehand as well, the festivals that have archive strands and so on, I think it just adds a bit of depth to sort of those big festivals. And I think they do it really well. I think they've really put in a lot of effort to make those events really sing and be an important part of the actual festival overall. So
absolutely, and I mean, it just shows what a really, really impressive commitment to silent film. The Archive Gala is always, I don't know if it will always be, a silent film, and always such beautiful scores. I still remember The Manxman at Leicester Square a few years ago, and this, I think, is going to be exciting. I'm going to get my frock on and watch a silent movie. Very happy.
Again? Who'd have thought?
Just when I've recovered from Pordenone, I'll be back.
Well, look out, though, in case people have to get some custard pies out.
Custard pies, you say, Peter?
I did mention them, yes. Yeah. So is there any news on custard pies?
There is some news in the custard pie front. Yeah, I'm assuming you guys have heard this, but the Mostly Lost Conference in America is a place where people who are experts on silent film get together to identify scraps of film. And there, someone just casually announced that they'd found the second reel of a two-reel Lauren Hardy film called The Battle of the Century. And this is a big find. It's basically slapstick gold. Battle of the Century is known for the fact that it has this epic pie fight in the second reel. Now, we have most of the pie fight. We have the first reel of the film, but this is going to more or less complete it, and we're going to see the end of the pie fight, which is,
you need to know who wins.
I think you need to sort of finally put a tin hat on the pleasure, shall we say, and the joy of custard pie flinging must be completed.
I'm a little worried, because my view on these things is that with custard pies in particular, less is a little bit more. You know, you can go a bit far, but that may be, of course, just that the pie fights of latter days have misunderstood the fine art of pie flinging and have just gone for throwing. I mean the end of Bugsy Malone, something that springs to mind, which I think doesn't really make much narrative sense.
Yeah, narrative sense is perhaps overrated in the sphere of custard pieing.
Perhaps.
Yeah, but I think the fight, the bit that we've got in the Battle of the Century is actually genuinely very inventive. And they're having fun. Half the joke is, how far can we spin this nonsense out? And they do spin it out, and it goes all around the town. And you'll see the little cameos from other silent film comedians in there. And it's one of the great scenes. And now it'll be finished. I'm going to see it at Pordenone.
Oh, no, I'm looking forward to seeing it after it comes away from Pordenone, because I'm sure it's set up. I mean, what I hope it has that balance that a film like, say, A Pair of Tights has, which has a good 10 minutes of similar kind of food-based flinging, which is ice cream in that situation, but is always inventive and just keeps it ups the ante without just falling into nonsense.
Well, we can trust Lauren Hardy.
I think we can.
Something that I'm a little bit less happy about is the Nosferatu remake. Now, yeah, no, I know they did this, but they're doing it again. Yeah. It was announced a few weeks back that a big Hollywood studio is planning a remake of F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu. Not a new Dracula film, but a complete remake of Nosferatu. And I'm worried. I've spoken to Pete about this, and we slightly disagree. I just feel that Nosferatu's influence on cinema is so great that it's in all the vampire films anyway. And it... you know, and the influence of expressionism goes even further. So the idea of doing a second remake, even though the director they've got teed up to do it, does sound very interesting. I'm afeared that it's going to be a little pointless, and it's going to lead people into making sort of apple and orange comparisons of different films. But you take a different view.
I do. You should be afraid, because it's Nosferatu. And a Nosferatu that doesn't scare you is not going to work. It probably won't scare you, this version. It probably won't be any good. I'm not a big fan of the last remake. You know, I don't think that Werner Herzog added much to it. It's, you know, but remakes are part of Hollywood and always have been. And I don't think it will in any way diminish the original. And if it means in a year and a half's time we have lots of reviews going, don't go and see this film. Instead, rent the old one, or get out, or watch on streaming, as it would be now, or buy even, heaven forbid, the original, the Murnau original, then that's all to the good. Nosferatu in itself, as we know, is a rip-off of Dracula. I mean, it is a version of Dracula.
It is a rip-off. An
unofficial making of Dracula, so I think it's completely within its own history for it to be ripped off itself. In some ways, it should be ripped off and not called Nosferatu, which I think you'd be happy with.
Possibly.
But, I think there are more things to worry about in the world than people using a brand which doesn't appear to want to bring lots of kids to the screen. You know, I really like the original. I want to see how this one turns out. So, I think in the end, you can't do Dracula. I mean, Dracula has been made so many times in so many ways that this will be, if it's a remake of Nosferatu, then it will be just another remake of Dracula, which is a little bit more faithful to the book and a very early film version. Mm-hmm. Or not very faithful either. It may be very unfaithful.
I suppose I'm just worried about them taking the look and without adding anything to it. And perhaps making people feel, you know, that it's been superseded. It sort of makes the original feel even older that it's coming around for yet another remake. But, you know,
it's coming up to a centenary, not a million miles off.
I like the old ones. So
really.
But I do admit I have to keep an open mind. Yeah.
And the look, of course, has been, you know, we've had Shadow of the Vampire, which played with the idea
that was a documentary, right?
Yeah, a documentary about how they made the film.
So
we've had the
making of,
and you know, and it's interesting because we've even had, of course, the Far Show riffing on the look of that particular vampire. Right. So I think I think it's firm and strong enough that a remake will not harm it retrospectively.
Okay, well, we're going to have to take this outside, I think.
Okay,
because you haven't persuaded me. Something we can agree on: we both love Greta Garbo.
Oh, yes.
And so we're a bit sort of a mismatch on Greta Garbo. Now, I'd seen a few of The Silence and you'd seen a few of The Talkies. So I went and watched Queen Christina this weekend. But what we both watched this week to even ourselves out is we both watched Flesh and the Devil. And it's a sumptuous film.
It is.
It's one of the great Hollywood Silence. I want to know what you thought about it, seeing it for the first time.
I mean, it's just so well put together.
She is, isn't she?
Well, she is. And I mean, I think the rest of the cast do help, but I think she carries the film pretty well. I mean, John Gilbert is actually pretty damn good in it as well.
She brings out the best in him.
But she does bring out the best. She brings out the best in pretty much everyone around her. But we are swooning a bit too much on Garbo. I mean, from a perspective of the kind of film it is, I mean, it is one of those classic melodramas where, for the want of a little bit of information, the entire film turns.
Yeah.
And interesting, I think what's interesting about it, and what's interesting from a perspective of Garbo, is that the character she plays, Felicitas.
Felicitas, the ironically named Felicitas.
Is what my mum would call a piece of work.
she's no better than she ought to be.
But actually, because Garbo doesn't play her that way, and you always have a degree of sympathy for Garbo in it, even though she has pushed people into, well, no, she has facilitated a move into some terrible situations for some people who should know a bit better, but also should have been truthful with one another.
For anyone who hasn't had the pleasure of seeing Flesh and the Devil, it's from the great Hollywood Silence, and it is a very steamy film.
Very steamy.
Greta Garbo and John Gilbert were a couple when they were making it, and it's a film about two best friends who are split up, basically, by a bad woman. And she's a very alluring bad woman. Tell us more, because I know you're really interested in the friendship between men.
Well, I mean, yes. yes, I am. Well, this, I mean, yeah, you want me to write about bromances in silent film for you, and I will one day. One day. But this certainly is one of the greats. The film starts with these two. I mean, we get a flashback to show them as boyhood chums becoming blood brothers.
Basically getting married.
Yeah, basically getting married. And, you know, they're at the same army training camp, and they cover for each other's daring do's and bad ways. And even when they get caught, they ship dung together and shovel the shit together, but are joyous, and they love each other so much, and they live in the same town, they go back home and they go to a ball, and then they stop talking to each other so much.
And then basically the film is so vivid and lively, and the camera's always zinging back and forth, and then Greta Garbo gets out of a carriage at the train station and boom.
Good donk.
Yes. Yeah, John Gilbert stepped in his tracks, and they have one of the most romantic sort of first kiss scenes when they share a cigarette in the dark, and there's a little light in the tip of the cigarette that sort of illuminates their faces, and then they have an incredibly steamy scene, which is basically one of the first films to get away with a horizontal love scene.
That's right, yes.
It is incredibly horizontal, and it's incredibly hot and heavy, and then her husband arrives.
So her husband comes in, a duel ensues, and This is where the plot of the film is problematic, in as much as we've been told that these two blood brothers are the closest thing to each other, but a terrible thing occurs, and he doesn't tell him why.
Yes, and Greta Garbo's character, Felicitas, proves herself to be the sort of living embodiment of who can't be with the one you love.
Yes.
I don't think we should give any more of the plot away.
No, we shouldn't. I mean, it does go pretty much the way you would do, and I think there are, you know, again, there are problems with the ending, which are problems mainly from the fact that it's Greta again, and you don't want the film to end the way it does in some ways because of it being Greta.
So which ending did you watch? Because there's a slightly different... So it ends badly for Greta. Yeah. It has to end badly for Greta. But there was a desire...
Yes, woe betide it be any of the men's fault in this situation.
No. And she's clearly a vamp and a badden. But there is a sort of tacked-on Hollywood ending where John Gilbert actually marries Barbara Kent, who plays the little sister of his best friend. And she's sort of been in love with him from the beginning. And yes, he sort of goes away happily with her. She's going to go away because she thinks, you know, he's not interested. But no, he decides to marry her, which sort of gets them back to being related. They're brothers-in-law instead of brothers. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's slightly annoying ending. But actually, the dramatic climax of the film, the real ending, has a most fantastic sequence with the spinning bullet, a close-up of a spinning bullet.
Yeah. Wonderful. I mean, and you know, we've got this beautiful snowy landscape.
It's too beautiful.
They've trekked out to the Isle of Friendship.
It's not really called that, as Mother points out.
Yes, to have it out with each other, and you know, yes, there are weapons involved, and yes, I mean it is. I mean, lots of little warnings for kids out there about how to play in the outdoors as well when it's cold.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean beyond the plot and so on, I mean, it just is a sumptuous piece. It comes in at a good sort of just under 2 hours, hour and 50, which is a perfect length.
You swoon.
It breaks nicely. All its bits, constituent parts, are the right length. So, and I think that's one of the things I really liked about watching it this week was just how well it's pieced together. You know, it's not just. I mean, the cinematography is amazing. There are some the first dual sequence.
It is with the shadows.
It's just amazingly done in silhouette.
Shout out to Clarence Brown. Rapidly one of my favourite silent film directors from the Hollywood era.
Very. I mean, some great tracking shots and some brilliant stuff with the train, on and off trains and around
with the horses who are spelling out Felicitas's name.
Of course, yeah. Felicitas. That's, I mean, it is just a wonderful piece of work. But I mean, everyone involved in it is great. There's not a dull performance. I think, and even with someone as strong as Greta Garbo in the centre, the other performances hold their own. I think it's good that when she's on screen, she is the centre of the piece. But
it's all you want to look at.
It is all you want to look at. And I do think that it is that interesting thing where the material in itself could have been rather dull and staid if it didn't have this chemistry that's in there between her and all the other characters.
I mean, chemistry. I mean, I think there's some beautiful little visual tricks and stuff like that, but they make a good idea, and Greta Garbo makes it, I mean, she makes it filthy, more or less. There's a scene when they're all taking communion, and the cup is passed from Gilbert to Garbo, and they're not meant to be together at this point, and instead of sipping from the communion cup where she's meant to sip from it, she switches it back so that her lips touch the cup exactly where Gilbert's were, and there's no mistaking the sort of physicality of it, and actually in that way she's such a brilliant vamp, because she is actually a woman of pleasure. She's not sort of the frigid, cold-hearted vamp who takes no joy in it. And I mean, Greta Garbo got away with things on screen that no one else did, and she plays a character here who, even while she's making other people suffer, you see that she's suffering, and somehow you allow it to happen.
I think that's the thing. I think that's what works so well in it. As you say, you see her suffering. You see her being at one with her better and worse nature. I mean, near the end of the film, where she has to make a choice about what to do, and she kind of refuses to make that choice, which is not a good thing, but is the thing that she will do. And
because sometimes you get used to being rich.
Yeah, and there are, so again, you know, the furs and the dresses and that she has. I mean, again, it just looks sumptuous. But it is, and I must admit, I don't know what score you have on your version, but if it's the Carl Davis, the Carl Davis score is tremendous.
It's beautiful.
Is so well done, and it is such a sweeping Hollywood score. And you know, I recommend that. I mean, I saw it online.
You mean somehow had some exclusive screener link?
No. I saw it. It's on in 480K on Daily Motion with the Carl Davis store, and it looks great. I mean, I put it on my big TV, and it came out brilliantly.
Well, yeah. And so, you can buy it. It is available on DVD on a TCM Silence DVD.
Yeah.
I would say that. Go out and watch Flashing the Devil if you haven't seen it. If you haven't seen it for a long time, enjoy. I actually saw it the first time at the Barbican with Stephen Horn playing piano.
Wow.
Yeah, amazing. That was fantastic. And if you've seen it and you like it, then you can't really go wrong with a good Greta Garbo silent. I'd say Woman of Affairs, also with Gilbert, or The Mysterious Lady with Conrad Nagel. I like that a lot.
Nice.
That's possibly a sillier film, even than Flashing the Devil, but...
I can go for silly. I like Garbo in a comedy. Ninotchka is one of my favourite films, after all. So
Ninotchka. Garbo laughs. Amazing.
Indeed.
We mentioned a talkie again.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. You know, for Lubitsch. Okay. So it's time for us to live up to our name now, I'm afraid, and depart the airwaves. Do join us again for our next Silent London podcast, whenever that may be. Thank you to SOAS for welcoming us into your studio. Thank you to Pete, to Alex Barrett, and thanks to you for listening. If you want to respond to anything we've been talking about today, you'll find all the details on the website at silentlondon.co.uk, together with those all-important silent film listings. Goodbye, and enjoy the silence.